bananas lately because a friend of mine told me that bananas are what they call the perfect fruit. They're just good for you in a lot of different ways. And I trust my friend, but I have no firsthand evidence of this. Even if there were studies, I haven't checked who made the studies. I take it on faith that bananas are indeed a good fruit, if not the perfect fruit. I'm tempted to recommend bananas to you, even though I have no firsthand knowledge of this. And I apologize for that fact, and I'm going to refrain from it. I'm not going to recommend bananas to you, but I will continue to eat them. And I challenge you to get in touch with your own relationship with bananas and the reasons behind your feelings and your loyalties. I also challenge you to listen to this podcast because I think you're going to like this episode. I mean, I think you're going to like this woman, Sasha Sagan, who I've had on this podcast before. She is now officially a friend of the show. And she's also kind of, I mean, in a way, somebody I relate to on a variety of levels, even though she grew up a secular Jew in the household of Carl Sagan, a famed scientist, and I grew up evangelical Christian in the household of Tony Campoldo, a famed evangelical Christian. The fact of the matter is we both have fathers that made our lives beautiful in some ways and difficult in others. And Sasha has she's found an angle that I really like. When I had her on before, I think it was right before she published her book For Small Creatures Such as We, which if you're wondering where that title comes from, it comes from a quote of her father who was like this astrophysicist and studied the universe and all the cosmos and all of that. And one of his kind of most famous lines was, "For small creatures such as we, the vastness of the universe is made bearable only through love." It's a beautiful line. It's like if you really understand how small and insignificant we are and how big everything else is around us, it's overwhelming. The only thing that makes it bearable is loving each other and loving being a part of something this glorious and huge and scary. And Sasha's book back then was about rituals and about creating rituals, sort of that would make life more bearable, that would make life more meaningful. What's interesting is that her fascination with rituals has extended. And now she has a podcast called Strange Customs. And Strange Customs is all about looking at the things that we do that we take for granted. Just rituals, like the way we get married or the way we celebrate Christmas, or the vacations that we take. They're not biological imperatives, but we have evolved them as part of our culture. And so Sasha, on this podcast, she brings people on to talk about a particular custom, and then she brings on some kind of scientist. So a lot of times she'll bring on a friend of hers, like some highfalutin friend, who's like a famous Hollywood actress or a famous writer, and they'll talk about the custom that this person has the best angle on. And then she'll talk to a scientist or a historian or some kind of expert about where this custom came from and how it fits into the human story. I have found it to be a really neat angle. And so I wanted to have Sasha on because I feel like our show is about trying to make the most out of this life and learning to use different people's lenses to find meaning in places where maybe we haven't found meaning, or to derive more meaning out of things that we little understood. And Sasha's got this really cool lens of looking at things that we're incredibly familiar with and looking at them from outside in a kind of a meta objective way that reveals things about them and about us that I think are useful. So listen, I could ramble on, but as you might expect, I'm about to share with you a conversation that's better than anything I'm going to say. Without further ado, this is me and Sasha Sagan, the host of the Strange Creatures podcast, talking about meaning and life and rituals and stuff. I don't know if you remember even being on my podcast many years ago.
Oh, yeah, of course I do. Of course I do. Bart, of course I do.
Okay. I thought, this is when you say, Bart, this is when I got the idea of podcasting in the first place. I had never heard of it until I met you.
It's like radio, but it's on your telephone. Well, what will they think of next?
So way back then, I feel like you were at the front end of discovering your niche.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I'm still, it's probably in some ways an ongoing journey, but I've been so lucky to get to sort of wander around different ideas and sort of find something that is really sort of strangely specific that I get to ask people questions about. I wrote a book. I loved it. It was a really amazing experience, and I'm quite proud of it. But one of the things I loved most about the whole experience of writing a book was getting to go on a book tour and going to meet people and talk to people in different bookstores around the country and different places. And this is like right before everything shut down. And, it was such a thrill to hear people talk about the rituals and traditions that they loved or detested or wanted in their lives or felt obliged to do or had invented, perhaps my favorite subcategory. And I don't know, I think that I really like talking to people. I'm kind of an extrovert. And I think that something about having these conversations with people in, bookstores and wherever else and online, it really just like, somehow that sparked the idea that maybe there was a talking version of this, like a podcast rather than a written version.
Well, I can really see how when you went on a book tour for that book, that there would be people coming up and going like, oh, this is where I get in on this conversation. Or, oh, this is, I can totally see how people would respond to you on that book. My question is, did you talk to a lot of people when you were writing the book? Like, is that book all out of your own experience and your own study, or were you interviewing people to try to get an angle on this ritual thing?
I mean, I did definitely reach out to, I did talk to people, and a lot of it was written, though. A lot of it was things I read, or I emailed, a professor about something, or, an expert. And it's funny, it was like almost, it was also, I feel like I was writing it mostly in like 2018, 2019. And it was sort of before we had this like, oh, we'll just get on Zoom with anyone anywhere in the world. I don't know, maybe other people were doing that, but I sort of feel like I'm much more inclined to do that now than I was then. And I was sort of over email a lot of it. And, a lot of it is autobiographical. A lot of it is my experience. And a lot of the conversations that really shaped the book happened many years before I started writing it.
It's so funny. You'll know where I grew up. I'm sort of like, are you evangelical about ritual?
No.
Like, are you trying to sell people on, hey, this is the way to experience more meaning in your life?
No. And I mean, it's a great question. It really is a great question, but I'm not. This is more my philosophy. If you are devoutly religious, terrific. You have your thing. I'm not here to like talk anybody out of anything or into anything. What I think I can be helpful with is if you are secular or you have a little nagging doubt or big category, spiritual but not religious bucket, and you want to feel like things are special, like the rhythm, you want to feel the rhythm of life, over the course of a year, throughout your life, you want to celebrate things, you want to, make things exciting and special for your children, for your spouse, for yourself. How do you do that without the infrastructure of religion? That's sort of where I feel like I can be helpful. And like the idea that things can be breathtakingly, thrillingly magical, for lack of a better word, without any supernatural, without relying on any mythology, and that we can actually look at the elements of our lives and of nature and our place in the vastness that are evidence-based and reframe them from being sort of cold and hard facts, instead of seeing them as like very dry and impersonal and like kind of unpleasant, we can find a way to, you know, overwhelmed with a sense of awe and wonder about things that are, you know, maybe easily get ignored or sort of just fade into the background.
It's funny that you say we're always maligning facts, because my experience since coming out of the religious community mm-hmm. and into like the secular world mm-hmm. is that the people that I met that were the most sort of ardently secular, they don't malign facts. They worship them. They malign transcendence. They malign emotion. They malign manufacturing magical moments.
Yeah.
Like, why should you need that? And I'm sort of like, have you not been looking, studying your data? Magical moments are really important to our health as human beings and to our communities and all that stuff.
Absolutely. And it's like how we, you know, so much of our connection with what we understand is the story that we tell ourselves about it, around it, you know, that makes it emotional. But I think that, you know, when there is a change in any society or often in a person, we overcorrect. You know, the pendulum swings too far in the other direction. And then eventually, hopefully, we get to the middle. And like, this is something that almost think it's like, I don't know if there's another way to do it. And certainly for people who, like, I mean, I was raised secular, so I don't feel like, you know, this need to like reject elements of like, you know, ritual and tradition, because they were not forced on me anyway. And it's just something that I really enjoy. But I certainly understand if you're brought up in, you know, in a religion that you eventually reject, how a lot of the trappings have to go away too, until maybe there's a way where we can parse out the parts that are really beautiful and that are really worthwhile and leave the stuff that doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
When you talk about parsing out, because what's interesting is it's always interesting talking to you, because your affect is the same kind of enthusiastic, breathless affect that I was so familiar with as a youth worker in evangelical Christianity. Like, there were all these just wonderfully excited young adults that were like basically saying, come on, kids, like it's all here. And so I'm always like, really? Are you sure you didn't grow up, you know, in some megachurch somewhere? But if you had, and I'm sure you got this when you were on that book tour, is that there's so many people for whom the core narrative doesn't work anymore, and they're just aching for the emotional resonance that they used to get out of confessing their sins at church, or out of singing a worship song, or out of saying a prayer in unison with a thousand other people. There are all these things that, like, it's funny because you have such a taste for this stuff, but you didn't grow up being force-fed it.
Yeah.
But if you grew up and that was the water you swam in the whole time, and then they take that water away from you, it's just, for some of us, just the longing is palpable for that kind of stuff.
And community, I mean, such a big part of it is a sense of community. And I think that, you know, I think there are so many people that I've talked to, people I've known in my life, who deep down, there's a little nagging skepticism. They're not on board, but they don't want to lose everyone they know, everyone who they have to, you know, this network of people who are there to celebrate with when things are going well and to mourn with, you know, when there's a tragedy. And support network of people, someone you can call to say, whatever, hey, my kid's sick, I have to go do this thing, you know, whatever it is. And of course we want that. I mean, that is so much older than any monotheistic worldview, you know, that's that. And I mean, I think that as secular people, you know, we have to figure out a way to build communities. And there's something about the rhythm of once a week, you all get together and it is like, you have to be there, you know, or you're supposed to be there and you see each other. You know, there's something about that that really like buttresses this sense of like, we are all in it together.
Yeah. I mean, I have to be honest with you. Like, there's been a real change in my life since the last time we talked. And that is that back then, when I was the humanist chaplain at USC and doing all this stuff, I really thought like, oh, I think we've cracked the code for secular community. Yeah. Like, it's going to be great. Like, we got it. And even when I couldn't stay there, partly because my wife was like, I can't stand living in LA, and partly because I just couldn't raise the money to stay a chaplain at USC.
Oh, it's so hard.
And if I could have stayed a little longer, I think my alumni would have funded the chaplaincy because it was proved life-changing for a lot of people who went on to do really good things with their lives. Way alumni will support their school, they would have supported our secular fellowship. But the weird thing is, then I came back to Cincinnati, and there were all these people that listened to the podcast who were like, yo, you're in Cincinnati now. Hey, would you start something like what you did at USC here? Not just for college students, but like, just start a congregation. Yeah. So we did. Yeah, after a few misstarts, it was growing, and it was like, got, you know, it's like 50 people showing up every other Sunday, and it's a beautiful thing. COVID crushed it. Just killed it dead. But it was also being held together by a lot of smoke and mirrors in the sense, or not smoke and mirrors, but like baling wire and duct tape.
Yes.
Because, you know, we got a free space that was available to us in some odd way because I had a buddy. But then when it came time to like rent a space, we couldn't afford to do that.
Yeah.
And I had like five really wonderful leaders who were all, and even though some of them were like 50 and 60 and some of them were 20 and 30, they were all sort of in graduate school. And so they could do it. They could run the organization and run the project. But then when they all graduated and got into their big hairy jobs, like they were like, oh, dude, we can't. And I just realized like we still have not cracked the code because those communities that have all those cool rituals that create all that transcendence, somebody's got to actually work on that stuff. And there's no economic infrastructure to do that. I'm calling you in a low moment. I'm calling on you in a low moment, sort of going like, tell me what you've seen. Tell me what you know. Like, give me hope that these rituals can find a home in a community.
It's interesting. I think it's like there's something about, there are certain points in our lives where like we really like reckon with like what we believe and like what we want. And I think that the parents of small children, I mean, when I was writing the book and it was sort of like, you know, trying to figure out who is this for, there were like two groups of people that I kept coming back to. One is like sort of that spiritual but not religious group where I kept thinking like there are people out there who like want to feel connected to the earth and the universe, and they don't love, you know, organized religion, but they're getting sort of swept up in like tarot cards and crystals and all this other stuff that is not evidence-based. And I feel like there is a way to really tap into that desire to sort of feel like everything is connected and you're part of something magical that is true without like, you know, going down that road of like astrology.
Yeah, I mean, because like everything actually is connected. And you actually are part of something bigger than yourself.
Exactly. But it's just not because of like what month you were born or whatever. Fine. So that group, which I kept imagining.
Parenthetically.
Yes.
I cannot, like there are a lot of, like, I understand when people are Christians. I understand, like, I cannot understand any grown adult buying into astrology, like, as
I know, I think I do understand. I mean, I'm constantly trying to talk people out of it at dinner parties and stuff like that. I'm like being like really a drag when anyone's like, oh, it's sign are you? And then I'm just like horrible and like make things very awkward at a party. But I do get it, which is that it's like, I mean, it is almost so explicit. Like crystals and astrology, it's like, I want to be connected to the earth and I want to be connected to the universe. And it's like, I want to feel like I am part of all of this. And like that urge, I can understand. It's just the get, you know, you, it's just made up this particular connection. It's like wanting to know the future. I mean, who doesn't want to be able to predict the future, you know, be able to get a clue to the future. And like, you know, you at the back of a fashion magazine, it's like important questions will be answered in the next month. And like, you know, I was like, oh, great. Phew. You know, and it's vague enough that you can be like, this is about me. But of course, if you read the other 11 past, you know, little paragraphs, okay, you'd be like, oh, this is about me. But
all right, so I apologize for that tangent, yes, because where you were going was...
No, not a tangent. It's related. Okay, but yeah, so the other group... Like,
they're the two groups, right?
Yes. The other group that I kept imagining reading this book was parents of small children who, right, you, because if you're secular and you're just, you know, in your 20s and 30s, let's say, and you're going about your life, you can kind of just do that in a way where there's not like some question hanging over you. But when you have to plan a wedding, when you have to plan a funeral, or when you're raising small children, all of a sudden you have to really reckon with what you believe, what you're willing to do because it's expected, what you're not willing to do because it's expected, and what actually represents like all these little symbols and all these rituals and all these little plays we put on for ourselves, each other. And I don't mean that derisively. Like, I love plays. Like, I love putting on, you know, a special thing. I mean, a wedding is a play. Like, I love weddings. I loved my wedding, you know. But there is this, like, sort of element of, like, what are you going to put this creativity and artistry and effort and time and money into? And I think when you have small children and all of a sudden they start asking questions, like really profound questions, just like eating, like, you know, like a bunch of crackers and just being like, what happens when we die? And like, you know, all the, like, you know, and you're like, oh God, okay, all right, we're gonna really do this. And like, who's God? And you know, all this stuff that you have to come up with an answer for. I don't know. I just think that I have two small children, and I think about this a lot and how to answer these questions. And I think
how
that
old are your kids?
Bring it
how
back. I have a 5.5-year-old and I have a 1-year-old.
Okay. Okay.
I just keep coming back to this idea to answer your question that when you have small children, like you need community more than ever before. And I wonder if for those of us who are secular, you know, sometimes it's the community at your children's once they're school age, you know, the other parents at the school, and like there are events and things, and it does give you a sense of there's a group and it takes a village. And like, you know, somebody says, oh my God, I'm stuck at this thing. Can you whatever pick up my whatever? If you're lucky, you have a group of people to rely on in those moments. But I do think that there is something about that moment in our lives when we have small children and we have to explain things to them and we want to give them the right, you know, air quotes, right answers, you know, and we want community. We need community more than ever because we're not, you know, we didn't evolve to have just like one or two adults raising children. That's not enough adults. You need like at least like 5. And so I don't know. I think there's something there. So I think you should open a secular play group in Cincinnati.
I mean, you know, it's funny, like it's not that we've given up. I mean, now I'm working on small groups because in those churches that I grew up in, real heart of the emotional content of the community was a small group, a Bible study, 10 or 12 people that got together every week to talk about their lives and to try to contextualize their values or their beliefs. You know, in their case, it was mostly beliefs. In our case, it's probably mostly values, but trying to contextualize them in everyday life and go like, how do we live out that value? If we say we care about this, you know, and so I am part of one of those now, 5 couples that get together. And that's been really transformational, figuring out how to provide that for other people, because the people that are in my small group, they're all really socially adept. Mm. They're charming people that I really like. But like most of the people that need community, like if you think about your average church or mosque or synagogue, it's made up of a handful of socially adept people and a lot of socially struggling people and people that are a little bit off. And like one of the reasons they find their home in the church or they feel so is because there's a place of welcome and there are events and rituals where they can participate without having to be at the center. Where they get carried along.
Yeah, or like win a popularity contest to be invited.
Exactly. And for the socially adept people, they can be in fellowship with those people. Like there's going to be singing and there's going to be a talk and there's going to be some prayers and then a covered supper. And so like they don't act, it's not the same as actually having to sit down in a restaurant across from somebody with whom you have very little in common and interact for an hour and a half. One of the good things about large group rituals is that it makes it possible for people to belong.
Yeah.
Even if they're not necessarily attractive.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think also just there's an, I mean, I'm curious what you think, Bart, like how much of it also is the element of like the feeling of like you should go, you have to be there. Like, you know, God will be mad if you don't go. Like, you know, how much of it, like, and when you don't feel like it, like if you don't feel like going to your whatever weekly exercise class, you know, maybe you're like, oh, I should go. It's good for me. But you're not like, it's moral imperative. You know what I mean? I think that like, I don't know, I'm curious about like how much of, you know, these traditions and these things that make life feel there's a steady rhythm. If you don't feel like really deeply obliged, does it work?
There's truth in what you say, but I'm a therapist now. Okay. I'm a professional therapist. Okay. So what happens is that secular people oftentimes have these same, if I was serious about being a good person, I would. Sometimes it's go to the gym or exercise. Sometimes it's go to therapy. Be like, oh, I know I need to get back into therapy. Like the same way a Christian would be like, I know I need to get back to church. They'd be like, I know I need to get back in therapy. Because there are these sort of formal ways in which we demonstrate to ourselves and to others that we're trying to be a better person. Mindfulness. Oh, I know I should be meditating. Right. I was doing that whole thing with Sam Harris and now I've stopped and I got to get back to that. And so the thing the church had was you also have to give money. So like God will be mad at you if you don't give the money to support the thing.
Right. That would be helpful for your situation.
It really would.
That would have been helpful.
Right. Cause like, I don't really want to be a therapist. I want to be a pastor. I want to sort of shepherd a community of people that are trying to become good in a similar way, but there's no economic model for me to do that outside of formalized supernatural stuff. So what's interesting though is, I mean, the people I feel like I need to really spend some time with public radio people because they're the only other people that have created this sense of, if you're a good person, you'll give.
You'll donate. You'll get a tote bag and then you can wear that tote bag all over town
and everyone signifies will know you're a good person.
Yes.
That's right. I think that that's the part, like, I think that one of the things, it's funny when I was thinking about your book and your podcast, but I want to get to the podcast pretty fast. But on the book, I was like, there was nothing in there about funding.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing in there about funding all of these rituals. But, you know, my experience with rituals is both in the secular world, like military, universities, the alma mater, the marching band, the sports games, like all of that stuff. Like there's money that has to change hands in order for these communal rites to exist. And I'm sort of like, hey, friends, if you want to have secular connection rites or tribal, like belonging things, there's got to be money attached to this.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is really interesting because like so much of what I think about when I think of like so many of our rituals and so many of the ones that have been really special to me are like within your household, within your family, within your group of friends who you're seeing anyway. You don't need to rent out a space. You just always go to whatever, you know, wherever you go. And I think it's true. It's like to reach the next level of like a larger group that's more expansive, that's not, you know, just the kind of thing that one person can organize easily. It does take so much more.
I look at you and I go like, gee, you're charming and you're educated and, you know, you're mobile and you were raised by bright parents and all of that stuff. I'm sure that you and your friends have lovely parties and gatherings and you probably have great rituals. Like that's the, like, but there's a whole lot of people, their circle of friends won't naturally come up with a really great ritual for what they do on Saturday night after the kids go to bed. Whereas you and your friends might be like, let's read poetry to each other, or let's sing a song. Hey, somebody gets out a guitar,
always,
let's sing.
We're always reading poetry
Shut
to each
up.
Other.
Shut up. You know what I mean.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, on the flip side of that, traveling the country and talking to people and like via social media, like, it is amazing how many rituals people do come up with and do stick with, maybe not forever, maybe not for their whole lives, but for years. And like the things that, you know, within a family or within a group or within a community, and we don't always even think of them as rituals, and they're not always formal things where, you know, everybody gets an Evite or whatever. Sometimes it's just the way we naturally come together, and suddenly we realize, oh yeah, after school on this day, we all take the kids to the playground. You know what I mean? Yeah. There are things that we do that may, you know, are not, maybe it's not a group of dozens of people, but maybe a group of 5 or 10 people who do sort of fall into these patterns, and they are rituals. We just often don't see them that way because there's not a centralized organizing force.
Which brings me to your podcast. Okay. Because I listened to, I've listened to a number of episodes of your podcast.
Thank you.
They sort of have a routine. Like you talk to a friend, like usually it's a friend who's doing something interesting.
Yeah.
Got an interesting angle on whatever it is that you're talking about. And then you talk to some scientist. Or some expert.
A historian or a scholar. Yep. Right. Yeah. Or a scientist. Okay. Yeah.
One that stuck in my mind, one of the ones that stuck in my mind was the one about Santa Claus and the rituals around, you know, the conspiracy, you called it.
Yes.
Where it's one of the few things where, like, as a society, like the older ones in our society dupe the younger ones. And then as soon as the younger ones figure it out, we go, oh, now you're in on the duping.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, like, I'm so troubled. I've always been so troubled by the Santa Claus thing. Not really excited about selling it to them. I'm not selling it to them.
No, we like, don't.
It's a terrible thing.
It's really interesting because it's like, so I grew up secular, but also Jewish. So like Santa was like not for me. You know what I mean? Like in any sense of the word, like Santa was like, I mean, it's funny because the conceit of the podcast is that I do a little very short introduction, like kind of tongue in cheek, as though I am like an extraterrestrial. I mean, not like a weird voice or anything, but just like the idea of like, if you were describing like kind of like an anthropological exercise, like if you were describing something human beings are doing from as far outside of ourselves as we can imagine, how would we describe it? It's very short little introduction. And that's kind of the conceit. And I often ask guests, like, how would you describe this thing we're doing? Marriage, let's say, to an extraterrestrial. But with Santa Claus, like I really, and Christmas generally, like I really do feel like an extraterrestrial. Like I feel like I'm on the outside looking
in. It's so foreign
to you. And Santa, I mean, obviously I grew up in America and like, it's not like I'm like, oh, tell me about this strange man in a red suit. What do you call him again? You know, I get it. I'm here. I'm from here. But it's not my thing. It's not, it never was my thing. And I never felt like it was intended for me, you know? And it's really interesting because, you know, I have little kids now. And I mean, my 5.5-year-old, like, you know, in the last couple of years, like, we've never said, and my husband was raised in a sort of secular Christian way, and he had Santa, and like, you know, that's part of his, like a normal person from America. So he's experienced it in the way that most people experience it. And like our daughter, we've never done, I mean, we just do Christmas with his family, but no Santa. And it's just amazing how it's so in the ether that like my daughter like knows so much about him. And like, you know, it's just this interesting iconography that it's like, it's not religious, but it kind of has elements of religion. And the expert, the scholar that we talked to who studies Santa, and it was so fascinating sort of comparing it to other demigods and deities. And it just, you know, all this stuff that we do, there's this like concept in, you know, anthropology 101, and I'm not an anthropologist, but I, you know, I admire answer. Maybe someday I'll go back to school. But like this idea of like making the strange familiar and the familiar strange. And that's really the ethos here. And like the things that we do, you know, as human beings that are so familiar to us that we've done for so long, either in our lives or in our culture, that it's really, really takes some effort to step back from. It's not that it's like, I mean, Santa, I'm definitely conflicted about, and we don't do Santa in our home, but it's sort of more about like, rather than being like, is this bad or is this good? Just being like, what does this say about us? And, you know, it's interesting because when I was like writing the book, I sort of thought that like, secular Jewish identity, because Judaism is like this weird, you know, is it a religion? Is it a culture? Is it, you know, just like you get, you know, when you do your genetic testing, it comes back, you're at risk for this. You know, what is it? I sort of thought it was different than other religions in, you know, in the way that it can, you can sort of be Jewish but not believe in any of the tenets. But so many people are secular Christians. You know, so many people celebrate Christmas who do not have any theological connection to it and still really value it. And I think that that's something that is revealing. And around Christmas time, the way people, what people do and what people don't do is really revealing, I think, about what we want and what we feel obliged to do and what we need.
And one of the things that we want that I picked up listening to your Santa episode was that we want to pass things down. We want to, I think you were, was it Nicole Richie that you were talking to? And she was saying that, you know, she just casually said, you know, in my family, we always went and got a tree on the day after Thanksgiving. And she's like, and in my family now, we always go get a tree on the day after Thanksgiving. And there's something comforting and familiar to her about that matters.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I guess I worry a little bit about, you know, when people invent their own rituals, and they last for a little while and then they go on. I go like,
yeah.
Part of the real value, cultural value and sort of psychological value of a ritual is to feel like you're part of something that started before you were born and will go on after you die. That's where I worry about the secular rituals that people are inventing that they don't, you know, I'm wondering like, how do you ground them in something that has some staying power? Have any examples of ones that you think?
This is my philosophy about that. First of all, we're all, like, even the most traditional person alive today is doing things so differently. Like, the most orthodox, like, the person who is most traditional, most like a time traveler, you know, from another epoch, is still doing things so differently than their ancestors were doing them. And I think that, you know, like everything, like rituals, they have to like mutate in order to survive. And I think that we are constantly doing that. And even the secular rituals, I mean, there's this paradox because I think a lot of like the secular rituals that, you know, we like invent, especially now as we're sort of like finding new ways to like, you know, come back to this like connection to nature and all these things and all of these rituals, all these holidays that are certain times of year, they are based in astronomical events like solstices and equinoxes and biology of the plants are blooming or, you know, whatever it is. And like we've superimposed for eons all these different stories and mythologies on top of them. But the real, you know, the deepest kernel of what this is about is something that is timeless. It's innate. It requires no story around it. And so the more we come back to that stuff, like it's springtime, like that just calls out for so much celebration, you know, or the longest night of the year, it's dark, we have to do something to sort of take the edge off. Like all that stuff, you know, is the most traditional in my opinion. And I think we can look at it from a totally secular, really scientific, really evidence-based point of view and still find all this joy in it and still feel like we're doing things that our ancestors were doing, because at a certain point you go back beyond, you know, the horizon of knowing anybody's names or where they were living or what their beliefs were. There are certain things that we can assume all of our ancestors were doing. And, you know, looking up at the night sky in awe and wonder and, you know, cooking meals with your group, raising your children together, you know, all of these things, they're the most traditional things. And all the specifics change over time. And I think allowing them to change is okay, is good. And, you know, there may be things, I mean, there are things that we all do that came out of belief systems that we no longer subscribe to that we might still love and can carry forward in a way that's not, you know, doesn't make us cringe.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that even if you tried to wipe out all the crazy beliefs and all that stuff, like the rituals were before the beliefs, like people die, you're going to stand around that corpse and figure out what to do with it. And
deal with your feelings.
Right. And however you figure it out and deal with your feelings, probably your kids will do something similar because that's what they saw you do. And people mate and people have babies.
Yes.
And yeah. So
I mean, coming of age rituals are like, I mean, one of my favorite genres. And that is so biological. It's so, we're so removed from like the, you know, idea of like all these hormonal changes and like hair and new places and all these weird things that were, you know, these chemicals that are coursing through the young person's body and they feel awful and, you know, all these things, but like all these beautiful coming of age rituals, and some are terrifying and some are like death defying and some are like, there's a whole range. They're about a biological change. That's wonderful. The next generation is coming into adulthood. They're going to take on, you know, the responsibilities. They're going to move us forward. And we should be able to, like, you know, celebrate that without necessarily, you know, feeling obliged to do them exactly the way they've been done.
Yes. So in some ways, it's like you've got, you know, you've heard of rose-colored glasses. And, yeah. And yours are not rose-colored, but it feels like you put on a certain lens and you look at the things that are going around on around you and you see them like you're finding meaning through a secular lens. The fact that there's no magic here doesn't mean that it's not grounded in reality or that it's not important or worthy of celebration.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is magic. It just depends how you define magic. I guess this is a philosophical question. If we understand how something works, is it not magical anymore? I mean, listen, even just here we are, we're in different cities, we're talking to each other, we can see each other through science and technology. Like, that gives me a thrill. It was something that I, you know, was only in science fiction when I was a kid, and now we do it all the time. I think that's amazing. And that, from the range of that to just like in springtime when like the flowers bloom, like, is that magic? I mean, just because we can understand it, like, does that take away from the thrill? I don't think it has to.
So you're doing this podcast. Again, like, if you're on an airplane and somebody sits next to you, like, what do you do? Or tell me about that podcast. Like, how do you describe what you're doing on the podcast? Like, what are you trying to accomplish with the podcast?
Yes. I'm trying to find a relatively, like, lighthearted way to reexamine the things that we do that and why we do them. And, you know, very ordinary things. And take this, you know, one of the things that my parents gave me and so many other people was this sort of cosmic perspective and this idea that the further we zoom out and the smaller Earth is, we don't know, you know, if there's anybody else out there or anything like that, but just to see our ways as not the only ways. You know, the idea that, you know, we're not the only stage. This is not the only show. And like, maybe there could be some other life forms elsewhere. What would they think of us? I mean, when I was a kid, we would, you know, explore this so much and like try to imagine what it would be like to explain something to an extraterrestrial. And I think that there's kind of joyful, kind of silly way to do this and look at ourselves with, you know, that
new
point
eyes.
Of view.
New eyes, yeah.
Yeah, new eyes. Exactly. And so I'm just having like the best time making this podcast because in each episode I get to talk to an interesting person, usually somebody I know a little bit or know really well, about something that they don't usually talk about. You get to choose what the ritual, what the tradition, what the custom is. And we've done, you know, episodes on like marriage and engagement, but also like slang and Santa and like all sorts of things that are, you know,
I mean, I know that you had written about that yourself, but then I'm thinking you talked to that actress whose name is going to escape me.
Yeah, Troy and Belisario. Yes. Yeah. And then to have those conversations about our own experiences and what it feels like to reexamine something and what we wish we had done differently or what we love and explore that. And then talk to someone who's, you know, a scientist or a historian or a doctor who understands the history, who understands exactly, you know, what's going on and try to get, you know, a little more context. It's really been so much fun. I think, I don't know, I love talking to people. So I'm having like the best time doing this.
You know, it's funny, like I think about the people that I talk to and that I listen through this podcast or whatever. And I think so many of them are trying to figure out lens that you're very familiar with, that you look at things through, is new. Like they just put on those glasses, right? Blinking into the glasses and sort of going like, how do I see this world in a way that it still seems magical to me, that it still seems meaningful to me, how do I look at things? And so I think this like anthropological lens where you say like, I want to take familiar things and make them seem strange. And I want to take strange things and go like, actually, that connects to you. That's not as strange as you might think. It's familiar. And we all do that in a different way than these people do. I think that's a really helpful, I mean, I guess I'm sort of trying to say like, I think your podcast would be really helpful to somebody who was new to magicless world. And who's trying to figure out like, yep, you reinvest it with some dazzle and with some emotional resonance. So it doesn't feel so lonely and it doesn't feel so flat. Be surprised at how many people tell me that once they leave the faith and this sense that they're part of a crusade to change the world into the eschatological utopia it's supposed to be, that like, they're like, yeah, you know, just, I don't know, just going to work, just, you know, like paying the bills. It seems flat. Like I used to be crusading for an eternal utopia. It's funny because like I was saying to John, we talked in sort of general terms about this stuff. And I'm like, but your podcast is so specific. You talk about the legal system one day, and then another day you talk about birth. And you're sort of taking these things that are central to our lives and that we have a lot of folk ways about and traditions about and rituals about and examining them. And what was funny was I was saying to John, when I saw the episode with Troy Belisario,
Troyan Belisario.
I was like, wait a second, Belisario. Like I'm of the generation. I was like, wait a second, Donald Belisario. He was the guy who produced Magnum PI and JAG. And like, you would see his name on all these action TV shows. And I looked her up and sure enough, I was like, oh my gosh. And all of a sudden I realized like, there's a tradition that you haven't yet examined that you should have me on to talk about. Nepo babies, nepotism.
Yeah. Yes. I know. I'm one too.
And I was raised by a famous Christian evangelist and whoa, strangely enough, I became a religious leader. And you know, and then you had Nicole Richie on the show and I'm like, she's a Nepo baby. Like, and you realize that, you know, that's been a thing that people are talking about now in the entertainment industry a lot, but that's as old as dirt.
Oh my God. I mean, it's monarchy is based on that, you know, whole forms of government are based on this idea that obviously I have benefited from greatly in my own life, but this totally ridiculous idea that because someone's good at something, kid's going to be good at it. I don't know. It's fascinating. It's a great idea for an episode, Bart.
I'm seriously, you, like I will do it with you. I'm obsessed with it because I grew up in the shadow of, you know, in my little evangelical world, which is actually isn't that little, there was nowhere I could go into my 40s where I wasn't
so
primarily understood as Tony Campola's son. And I know that's, you know, I mean, like, I know that's your shtick. It's happened to you your whole life, right?
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. It is really interesting. And, you know, I feel very proud to be my parents' daughter.
Sure.
And, like, I feel like I can, you know, I think it's also different. I don't know. Maybe it's not different. But in my mind, because my dad is no longer alive and is, you know, died when I was 14, I feel like this, like, it can help in some small way. I mean, his legacy is beautiful. It's global. It's amazing, you know, how many people who were born after he died know about him. And so, you know, he lives on in this way. I also feel like because he's not here, like maybe I can help a little bit to sort of just like, I don't know, just
push it forward,
carry
push it down
on
the road.
Some of his ideas and his brilliance and his awe and wonder.
One of the things I was thinking is like, I got all these opportunities as a young man. Where like my dad put me in charge of things when I was young and he would have never put another 22-year-old in charge of that. And you go like, well, that's ridiculous. And you go like, yeah, but the thing is like I had an accountability to him that the other 22-year-olds wouldn't have had. Like if I screwed up, I had to live with him. They would have just gone on and left him behind. And so in a sense, like nepotism, it's not just that it makes sense emotionally. Like, of course, we're going to try to clear obstacles away for our kids. But it also like, it kind of works in some ways. Like there's an argument you can make for it.
I mean, the other thing is you're like from childhood, you're being taught the philosophy, you know, so it's in there. But the problem is, of course, that there are lots of other brilliant, worthy people who don't get a shot because they don't have the connection. And that's why it's really, you know, and even something like, you know, internships, like unpaid internships, which I did when I was young, because I was like, I didn't have to work in, you know, a job that paid me in the summers when I was in college. And I could, I did sometimes work jobs that paid me, but I also was able to do things that were like this experience that you're going to get. And I benefited from that. Whereas, but that was from a position of being privileged enough to not have to work all summer. You know, there's so many things like that.
But that's why I think you should examine it, because I think if like, you know, because I think if you examine it from outside, from an interplanetary perspective, you would go like, but of course, every other species does that. And we call it natural selection. Like, you know, like, of course you want your, you fight harder for your DNA than you do for somebody else's DNA. And that's how it works. That's how we got here. Listen to enough episodes of your show that I think that this would be a good episode of your show.
I love that. I love when people like pitch ideas too. And like on social media, it's so great. And often it's stuff that we're already working on.
Right.
But like, I think this is a really good idea. And you know, just like there are so many things, once you sort of put on those proverbial glasses you were talking about, just all of, I mean, I'm in my walk-in closet where I record, and it's just, I mean, clothing, like there's just so many things that you start to think, like, what if you didn't just take these things for granted that you, that have been with you all your life?
Oh, I've got your guest for clothing, by the way.
Oh, who's that?
A woman I went to high school with. Her name is Dana Thomas. And Dana was I didn't know it when we were in high school. She was just a beautiful girl that I had a crush on. But it turned out that like her parents had split up and she was having to sort of basically kind of earn enough money to go to college by being a fashion model.
Yeah.
She ended up becoming a fashion writer, and she wrote a really very provocative book a couple of years ago about disposable clothes and what they're doing to the economy of our planet. And like, she's the most socially aware fashionista that you'll ever
Perfect.
Meet. So
great. Great. She can be the expert. I love it.
hey, before you go though, park this show on this Only Sky platform. Tell me about that.
So it's a new company, and you know, it's sort of about secular storytelling, and it's media, and they have podcasts, and they have news and essays and opinion. And it's really interesting because it's sort of like telling a secular point of view without being sort of
dick.
Yeah, I was going to say holier than thou, but that seems like the opposite of holy than thou. Yeah, exactly. Without being a dick about it. And they've been so great, and we've been having so much fun making this. And, you know, they originally reached out to me to say, do you want to, you know, write essays, which is sort of what I've mostly done until now, is write. And I was like, well, sure. But I also have this idea for a podcast. And they were like, great, let's make it, which was wonderful because I'd been really wanting to make this for a long time. And I'm just having a ball.
Is it at the place where you're getting enough feedback that you've, because like when I make these podcasts, if nobody writes or says anything about them, I'm sort of like, was it terrible? Did nobody like it? And then I realized like, I listen to podcasts all the time and I never send a note.
No, totally. I know. It's like, I just recorded the like, sorry, but like, could you like rate and review if you don't mind, if you have a couple minutes, I'm sorry, listener, to bother you. But like, you know, I mean, yeah, I get people. I mean, social media is so great because I, you know, it's not like people necessarily have to like sit down and, you know, they just comment, and it's like, not like I'm going to sit down and write a review of my experience of listening to this, but it's been great. So interesting to see what people really connect to and what people have either say, yeah, I've always thought this is so weird. Why do we do this way? And on the other end of the spectrum, the stuff that people say, oh, I've never thought about this before. Of course, this is so arbitrary and strange, but I'm just so used to it. I never realized.
That's my sister-in-law who always says, no matter what's going on, she just goes like, just remember, it's all invented. This is as close as I come to a plug show where somebody's like, they're coming on and they have a new product and I want them to talk, like they want to talk about it, and I want to give them air space. And in a sense, like I really do motivated, hungry for people to experience more of the wonder of life than they're experiencing. And as a therapist, you know, people will come in with a problem or a difficulty and I'm always trying to like, is there a way that we can remove this anxiety or get around that depression? Or is there a way we can process this trauma so that this person can more fully enjoy the privilege of being alive and of being conscious. And so I think that what you're doing is you're giving people perspective, a way of looking at their lives that will enable them to enjoy them more. You know, they always say like mindful eating. Like if you think about what you're eating, you end up enjoying the food more. Or gratitude, you know, like if you end up stopping and thanking for something that they've done for you, a year later, that will sit with you longer and you'll still remember it. Like that there's something about attending to our lives that makes them richer and fuller. And I just think you're just a really wonderful guide to attending to this part of life. And I'm just so grateful to you for making the show.
You're so kind. Thank you.
No, you're genuinely welcome to the encouragement, because I really want you to be encouraged. And I want to encourage people to kind of engage with you in this way, because I think you can help people that need help to enjoy their lives even more than they're enjoying them right now.
Thank you. I mean, I really do believe in that. And I really do think that there is so much joy to be had and so much awe and beauty in the way things really are. And that we don't have to invent things in order, and I don't mean like art, but we don't have to invent our reality in order to, you know, in our understanding of things in order to make ourselves feel better. I think so often the reality, the evidence base, the nature as revealed by science is enough and more than we could have ever imagined. And if we just, you know, sort of frame it the right way, there is just boundless beauty to be held.
Yeah. It's funny because all the time you're thinking of that, I'm thinking of, because you have a 5.5-year-old, I have a 4-year-old granddaughter. And, lately she discovered The Lion King.
Mm.
And so around our house, we spend a lot of time singing From the Day We Arrive on the Planet.
Mm.
And blinking, step into the sun. There's more to see than can ever be seen, more to do than can ever be done. There's far too much to take in here, more to find than can ever be found. But the sun rolling high through the sapphire sky keeps great and small on the endless round. Mm. And then, you know, and I just think like, that's the deal, is like, we don't need to invent anything. There's more here than we'll ever see. There's more here than we'll ever do. There's more here than we'll ever understand. There's plenty of wonder without having to invent it.
Couldn't agree more.
You're a good woman. And you know what? To the degree that you say, like, I'm trying to carry on the family tradition, I'm trying to extend this perspective that I learned at the dinner table into the wider world, I think you're doing a really good job of it.
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you. And it's just such a pleasure talking to you always.
All right. Listen, when you're ready to talk nepotism, come and find me.
Yeah, absolutely.
All righty, my friend. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. All right. So that was me and Sasha Sagan. And I hope you liked it. And I want to thank you. Wait, before I thank you, I want to thank some other people, because you know that this show is made possible by people patronizing it through Patreon, but you don't always know all the good people that do that. So, you know, some of us are just freeloading, but not Mike Venditti, not Jeff Martin, not Chad Godfernan. These are three people that support the podcast through Patreon, and there are more. Yay! There is Rob Stassen and Barbara Koffel and Cody Ray and Emily. You might think, is that it for today? No, there's three more. There's Garrison Alvarez, Adam Brotherwood, and Jacob Ward. These people care. They put their money where my mouth is. That's it. They put their money where my mouth is. In fact, I'm speaking into a microphone bought by these people. And I'm grateful to them. And don't get me wrong, I love you too. I'm grateful to you for listening. I hope it was a good experience today. I hope you got something out of the conversation. And you say, like, but do you have a quote for us? And the answer is yes, I do. It's a quote actually from Sasha's dad, Carl, who had lots of great quotes. But here's one I like a lot. I like a lot. After the Earth dies some 5 billion years from now, after it is burned to a crisp or even swallowed by the sun, there will be other worlds and stars coming into being, and they will know nothing of a place once called Earth. Now, that may sound frightening to you, but it's liberating to me. Whatever your biggest mistake of today was, I promise you 5 billion years from now, it literally won't mean a thing. And so, with that happy note, I leave you till next time on Humanosmy.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. Also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith, me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. You could be larger than life.